Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, I have a short but topical stat waddy.
Ooh, topical.
It's topical because we had the elections on Thursday and we couldn't escape the presence of the vastly irritating Count Binface, whose slightly trying policies, I don't need to remind you, David, included renaming London Bridge Phoebe Waller and the moving of the hand dryer in the gents' toilet at the Crown and Treaty in Uxbridge to a more sensible position. Oh, gosh, it's annoying, isn't it? Are you annoyed already? I don't know.
I always feel sorry when I see the count, you know, the declaration of results. I genuinely feel sorry to see people who devoted their lives to public service and many different political parties being surrounded by attention-getting loons.
Yeah, wearing stupid hats.
I'm sorry. You know, put them somewhere different.
And they're getting less votes than them. But anyway, is it time for a round of soul-sapping UK political candidate or fun-loving Calypso star? All right? I've got eight for you. Lord Shorty, electoral hopeful or Trinidad crooner?
Oh, very good. Electoral hopeful.
No, Lord Shorty, was a Calypso singer from the 60s and 70s, known as the father of soca and the love man.
Very good.
Lord Buckethead.
That's got to be a candidate.
It is. Yeah. No. Right. He was. He stood against Margaret Thatcher in Finchley in London in the 1987 general election. He campaigned to demolish Birmingham and to make way for a spaceport. Got 131 votes. Howling Lord Hope, our boy at the hustings, or a man singing rude songs about plantains?
A man singing rude songs about plantains, surely.
Well, no. Together with his pet cat, Cat Mando, he took over as the party leader from Screaming Lord Such in 1998. He's also the mayor of Ashburton. It's working, isn't it? It's working. Okay, the Duke of Iron. The Duke of Iron. Is that an electoral irritant?
That's Calypso. Yes. Calypso, surely.
Yeah, he's a Calypsonian nightclub and concert entertainer, recording artist from the 1930s. Attila the Hun, joke candidate in comedy costume or warbling toe tapper?
Warbling toe tapper?
Yes, he was. Calypso singer from Trinidad. Yes. Sang and began in 1911. One of the pioneers for spreading the awareness of Calypso beyond its birthplace, it says here, together with the Roaring Lion. Okay, three to go.
Roaring Lion, what a great name.
Roaring Lion's great, isn't it? Mr. Yeah. Fish Finger. Was he looking for votes or for record sales?
He was looking for votes.
He was. Mr. Fish Finger was a man dressed as a piece of frozen food who stood against the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Tim Farron, in Cumbria's Westmorland and Lonsdale in 2017. And astonishingly, he got 309 votes.
I'll tell you what, these candidates are a lot funnier and more charming the way you talk about them. If they'd pulled up on your doorstep, you wouldn't have been amused at all.
I would be remotely amused. It irritates me so much. All right, two to go. Angus the Monkey. Did we vote for him or did we dance to him?
No, Angus the Monkey isn't, because the story goes that the people of Hartlepool many, many years ago once voted for a monkey, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
So there's no connection with that at all.
I thought it might have been a connection. It might have been the mascot of a local football team as well. I can't remember now. But no, he was Stuart Drummond.
All right.
The only directly elected mayor of Hartlepool.
All right. And there you go. Okay.
What? Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. And the last one is Growling Tiger.
Oh,
mayor in the making or Caribbean Songbird?
Caribbean Songbird, yes. Surely.
Yeah, he's a boxer who won the Trinidad Flyweight Championship in 1929.
Do you know, I do love a bit of Calypso.
So do I.
I mean, you know, because we always used to say that the one form of music that never failed in the Word office was ska. You could always put on ska. Everybody likes ska. Didn't matter who they were. Same thing applies, similar to Calypso music.
It's impossible not to like
classic Calypso music. You know.
The number of times that I've heard London is the Place for Me on documentary.
Oh, God.
And it's
great
such
record.
A fabulous record.
Fabulous record.
Fantastic piece of advertising and propaganda. And it's so sweet. And
while we're talking about trivia, When do we ever talk about anything else?
But, you know, While we're talking about trivia.
I don't know if you noticed, I don't know how this surfaced this week, the late, great Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah.
This popped up on social media. He said there were three things in life that were overrated. Did you see this?
No, go on.
Okay. Champagne, anal sex, and picnics.
Martin Amis was going to be one of them.
Perfect.
Champagne, anal sex, and picnics. My God.
That's so good.
In and his I thought, mind, he would have combined all three on some point, I should imagine.
I couldn't possibly comment on the middle one, but I don't think champagne is overrated at all.
Impossible to overrate champagne unless you buy cheap stuff.
But picnics, yes, picnics are overrated. I'm completely with him, you know, because as soon as, you know, you get any food out, flies
arrive,
wasps from all over the place. And I thought, is there anything in this? You know, if you had to pick three things that are overrated, and these are my three.
Oh, go on.
Okay. Drugs are overrated because I cannot see a situation where drugs doesn't turn normal people into raging bores. Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. I completely agree with it.
Drugs, acoustic sessions are always overrated. You know, Radio One is full of them. People sitting around on stools, you know, doing kind of slow, rather delicate versions of things that used to be big banging classics, you know, and they're looking rather pleased with themselves because they managed to do this. That's overrated. And the third
Nirvana on an Unplugged was pretty good. That's the one exception.
That's the one exception. I'll give you that.
That was pretty good. As was Eric Clapton, actually, but it was pretty good. But I know what you mean. It's the idea that it's somehow meant to be better.
Somehow meant to be purer.
Yeah.
Anyway, the third thing that's always overrated, so we've had drugs, we've had acoustic sessions. Here's the third thing that's always overrated. Always the new album. The new album is always overrated. It just is. Because in the few weeks where people are referring to it as the new album, there are two sets of people who have opinions on it. One, the people who made it, whose job it is to tell you that it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And two, the small number of people who bought it, whose job it is to justify the fact that they bought it by saying it's absolutely amazing.
And it's therefore a very steep graph heading downwards, isn't it? Because you're desperately wanting it to be good, and then you suddenly think, is it quite as good? And you go back and just double check that it could be anywhere near as good as the one you liked that came out 10 years ago. And it isn't.
It's not.
I know.
It's just also,
it's that cliche that they always have to say, and I can understand it. I mean, you know, if it's your new album, you've got to say that it's finally what you were meant to sound like. It's all come together in the studio. And no, you're right. Miserable disappointment.
So there you go. Drugs, acoustic sessions, and the new album.
I like
it. So you can think about your own three for next week. And if anybody else has got their own three.
Yeah, chip in, please.
Three things that are always overrated. So what were you saying about Bob Marley?
Well, Bob Marley, it is, very sadly, on Tuesday the 11th of May, the 40th anniversary of his death.
My God.
So I can distinctly remember, because I just joined Smash Hits. Was working with you for the first time, and I can. In fact, you did. I think you did an obituary on Old Grey Whistle Test. Probably the only obituary, as you imagine. I don't know. At that time, those things were not really marked, were they? Also, it was a real surprise. I mean, none of us really had a clue.
No, how bad
Marley
he was.
Wasn't well. We knew he wasn't well, but we didn't know that it accelerated to that extent.
Yeah.
So, it's so sad to think of that because he was so young. How old would he be? I can't work it out now. 36, no, 37, something like that. 45, I think. I mean, really, really young. And I saw him once, and I saw the last London gig, and you saw that. Well, you saw the Lyceum. You saw the Lyceum gig. There were two, I think, weren't there? It was finished up on the live album. Fantastic.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
That's
genuinely one of the most revelatory things I've ever seen and heard, because you turned up there, you had never heard a band like that, because there wasn't a band like that, you know, which was a reggae group that kind of fronted up like a rock band. It was amplified like a rock band, kind of mixed like a rock band, you know, was intended to kind of sound like a rock band. But he had this extraordinary, you know, bass and drums bottom that just shook the old Lyceum. And isn't it wonderful once again to reflect? I think
was the roof
about,
open?
The roof was open on the Thursday. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
And I think we were talking about this with, was it Ricky Lee Jones we were talking to about this? That so many of the great buildings for live rock and roll were actually built for kind of Victorian musical, you know, or Victorian theatre. You know, they were not designed for that kind of thing at all, but they're just absolutely perfect, like the Shepherd's Bush Empire and all those kind of
things.
Yeah,
well, they're the right shape, aren't they?
They're the right size, they're the right shape. Yeah. I don't know what it is about it. But anyway, you know, this, you felt you were inside this box that was just, you were all being vibrated by the sound of this rhythm section. And he managed to, I know what I said earlier about drugs always making people really boring. But it wasn't the case in Bob Marley's case, because he always struck you as being simultaneously out of his tree
and incredibly focused and on it.
Utterly on the money.
I know.
Utterly on it.
Never missed a cue. Absolutely.
Never.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
He wandered around the stage. He'd do this kind of marching action across the stage and then slowly make his way back to his mic and arrive absolutely at the second. That he was,
and also he was so kind of physically accelerated. You know, my distant memories of people sitting around smoking dope was people just crash out on listening to Metal by the Pink Floyd on scatter cushions. But this, he was so kind of, you know, physical, wasn't he? Leaping about, dancing. You know,
he was extraordinary. I mean, he was like, you know, he was a preacher. He was he had that kind of thing, you know. Yeah. He reached to the back of the place, you know, and pulled you in, and it had that. It had that revival meeting feeling about it. And also, because this is 1975, and it's, you know, nowadays if you go to a gig, you can pretty much predict who's going to be there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those kind of people for that kind of gig. It wasn't like that in 1975.
There was a huge mixture.
I mean, you know, kind of African,
very hip people,
African diplomats, Time Out readers, you know, kind of, people who worked in record shops, and then youth from Brixton, and you know, and it felt slightly dangerous. Actually, you thought, my God, well, I've never been to anything like this.
Nobody, but also, it's the way. Like no one had. It was the way when I saw them. I mean, it was sad. It was their last London show, and I think it was the biggest London show. It was at Crystal Palace Bowl on, I think it was the 7th of June, 1980. And the thing that struck me was that, you know, most rock bands, you said that rock bands go on and they kind of perform at you. They've got a show that they've worked up, and it's been thought through, every aspect of it, and it's a great big kind of performance. And the impression I got with them was that they were consumed by their own music.
Yeah.
As if they were unaware of anybody else but themselves. They were transported by the sound that they themselves were making. Which I'm sure is a kind of nonsense, because I'm sure it was as rigorously storyboarded as any other show, really, in that they'd had to work out.
I don't know, it probably
worked,
wasn't.
But
it probably
I really
wasn't in those days. Yeah, but it's fairly innocent times compared to nowadays.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I found it very, very affecting that they just went on and just did the show, completely entranced by the sound they were making, without any attempt to kind of to do all those really obvious things that connect with an audience. And I thought that was really, really attractive. And they were fantastic. I mean, they still had the Barrett brothers. They still had all three of the original I3s, their junior, Marvin and Al Anderson. And it was just, they were wonderful. But Bob looked very thin and a bit tired, actually. And he was really ill, because he'd become ill in 77, hadn't he?
Yeah.
And it was awful when you think about it. I mean, he was told, I think, that he had to have a malignant tumor on his foot amputated, and he wouldn't do it for religious reasons.
Yeah.
And it's so sad, you know. Had he could have lived, I'm sure, a lot longer. He might still be with us now. You really don't know.
But I suppose the thing that you realize when you go back and listen to the records is just how much he did
in a
quite short period of time. You know, you know, it's hard to say that he didn't achieve pretty much everything he wanted to achieve.
That we saw was like a greatest hits show. It was. Yeah. It was Natural Mystic jamming.
Because,
you know, woman,
because
you know,
that's the thing you have to remind yourself about with Bob Marley. You know, radical music in musically and kind of lyrically, and introduced loads of ideas into the kind of into the national debate that would never have been introduced without Bob Marley at all.
Yeah.
And yet got played on the radio, was on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Got top 30 records. He was absolutely in the bloody mainstream. You know what I mean?
Absolutely mainstream. Yeah,
because he could write. Well, he was more than just writing, wasn't he? He could contrive, he could sing in a way that was... Because whenever you heard a Bob Marley record, you thought, oh, God, I've heard that before. But you hadn't heard it before, but it immediately sounded familiar to you.
It did.
And you thought, you internalized it really quickly, you know what I mean? Because he just had that knack. And I think he also had a voice that seemed to... I think Chris Blackwell said this. He had a voice that always sounded great on the radio.
It did. It sounded incredible.
And it just came through.
It's like on narrow that. Sound.
Absolutely.
Projected.
Yes, really.
Like Bob Dylan's got very narrow.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. I was thinking back to his life and some of the extraordinary things happened to him. And one of the things I'd kind of forgotten, actually, was do you remember in 1966 he went and lived in Delaware?
Yes.
I mean, you kind of forget that. You know, you just kind of like Bob Marley, you know, as the Wailing Wailers, and then it Cox and Dodd studio, and then he kind of developed to this stage. No, he didn't. No, at the age of whatever he would have been, 20 or 21, he'd just married Rita, and his mum had moved to Delaware. And he went and lived in Delaware, and he worked, I think, on an assembly line at Chrysler, and then he worked on a night shift. There's a song, isn't there, on whatever it is, Rest of Man Vibration Night Shift, where he talks about, you know, driving a forklift. So that's presumably what he did.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean, he wasn't in any way kind of lost and thinking he was going to get out of the whole business. I think he'd been so, I felt he'd been ripped off by the fact that he sold 70,000 copies of Simmer Down and then he made any money out of it. So he wanted to start his own record label. But I think that's amazing.
You well, know, also 50 years ago this week, do you know where he was? Because I do. He was in Sweden. He was in Sweden, in a house which looks like, if you see the house nowadays, it looks like Big Pink.
Yeah.
He was in a house with Rabbit Bundrick writing tunes for Johnny Nash to sing on the soundtrack of a Swedish film which Johnny Nash was in.
Oh, wow.
So he was brought, because he'd met Johnny Nash. Johnny Nash had kind of adopted him, you know. Johnny Nash recorded Guava Jelly and Stereotype and so forth. And so he was identified as a talented young man. All right, come over to Sweden, write some tunes for this film I'm making. So he spent...
So it wasn't all what people imagine, you know,
no,
he'd
done
kind
all
of Rastafarian kinds of... spiritual journey.
And
you know, he was just a working musician.
Don't forget, the thing about Bob Marley is he was, you know, white father, black mother.
Yeah.
So he passed back and forth across that line quite easily. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He looked like people's idea of a rock star.
Yeah, he did.
Which certainly worked for him. But he'd done all kinds of things. Yeah, definitely.
Incredible. And also the assassination attempt. You think about that now. That was 2 days. It was only a year after that Lyceum concert, 1976. And, you know, I think what he thought what had happened, I think, was that Edward Seeger, the Jamaican Labour Party, had figured that he was supporting Manley at the concert that was coming up in 2 days' time and sent the gang to kind of to murder them, to assassinate them. And it's amazing. If you think about it, he was shot. Rita Marley was shot. Their manager, Don Taylor, was shot. They all recovered, and 2 days later, he played the show. It's incredible when you think about it. What do you think? That kind of fortitude, I just can't imagine people now being in an assassination attempt and then going out and playing to 60,000 people 2 days later. It was absolutely astonishing, really.
I suppose it goes back to what we're talking to Richard Thompson about the other day. And if you haven't heard that, go and listen to it. We talk about how quickly Fairport Convention, you know, recovered from their terrible van crash in 1969. And he was saying, well, maybe we had more in common with our parents' generation who'd gone through the war than we thought.
It's stiff upper lip. It's good to carry on. It's okay, let's get on with it. Let's not hang around. Let's not sit and feel sorry for ourselves. There's work to be done.
Let's not go on Oprah.
I know.
It was different times.
But listening to, I was listening to I Shot the Sheriff yesterday and thinking, what a fantastic song that is. Yeah. Don't you think the opening line, I Shot the Sheriff, is one of the great journalistic openers of any song. It's absolutely gripping. And you desperately want to know what happens next. And then you get no real information at all.
Yeah.
You know, there's this description of events. Your imagination has to fill in the gaps. You know, you get the bare bones of information that Sheriff John Brown has been gunning for him for his weed cultivation and has been presumably killed because it's a capital offence in self-defence. And that the deputy was apparently shot by somebody else. It's an amazing song. And all you get is this kind of, you don't get any notion of the story. You just get these lovely little bits of philosophy. You know, reflexes got the better of me. And what is to be must be. And every day the bucket goes to the well and one day the bottom will drop out. It's an amazing song. So it's very lightly sketched in.
Here's my question to you. If somebody came out with up with that tomorrow, would Radio 1 play it?
No, they wouldn't. Think of all the problems they have with Cop Killer. I mean, you know, which this was, I think this was brought into the argument, wasn't it? No, of course they wouldn't. I mean, I Shot the Sheriff. It's extraordinary. I know.
I was listening to one of my Bob Marley favourites, which is Exodus.
Yeah.
Which I do think is interesting. I mean, musically, I think it's an interesting bridge between kind of reggae music and club music.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to it and you think you can hear a massive attack coming
in the distance.
You know what I mean? From the other direction.
Yeah.
And it also reminds me that one of the things I loved about him was that his songs were so full of biblical references because that's what he'd grown up with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so the very idea of Exodus and movement of Jar people and it's Israel and the pharaohs, you know, crossing the Red Sea. That stuff just went through all his stuff. But the other thing I absolutely love about it, and if you go and listen to it, you know, it occurs in the first 30 seconds, is when you hear him just laugh. Do you remember that bit?
Yes, oh yes.
You know, I can't remember exactly where it comes, but you just hear him go, and they left that in. And it's such a thrilling sound.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the things he was good at. Is the odd little idiosyncrasies about his delivery. He didn't deliver like anybody else on earth, it strikes me. He made everybody else seem really boring in the way that they did anything, you know. So once he did it, that's the only way you can imagine it being done.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I've become obsessed latterly with comedians in cars getting coffee.
It's really good. The Jerry Seinfeld thing. Yeah,
which I slowly over a period of years, I used to catch bits of it on the internet, but it's all on Netflix nowadays, or most of it's on Netflix, and the new stuff's on Netflix. And I've just got into a thing recently where I just have to keep, I watch one and I think they take about 20 minutes. I think I'll watch another one. And then
they're
I'll
really
watch
short.
Another.
I know.
They just, It's a beautifully simple idea, you know, which is Jerry Seinfeld just rings up a comedian and says, let's go and get coffee. And he always turns up in a slightly nicer or stranger car, more remarkable car.
Which occasionally breaks down.
Which very occasionally breaks down. The sun is always shining, which I think is a very important point. And they go off and they have coffee and they just chit-chat about, you know, about the trade of being a comedian. And it just works. And I think one of the things that makes it work, I mean, think about this a lot, is it's morning. It's always morning. And so the sun is always shining and the coffee is always on. So you've always got a sense of optimism.
Yeah,
nothing has been spoiled. You know what I mean? You start the day with this. And you look at it at first, you think, this is so simple. And then the more of it you watch, you realize it's fantastically produced. It's really carefully thought about in absolutely every aspect. And obviously behind the scenes, there are hundreds of people laboring away at it to make it as perfect as it is.
And well, they... you're never aware of anything but just the two of them in the car. But they've got the car cameras. They've got the car in front with the cameras, the one behind following them. They've got when they're in the cafe, presumably that cafe has been taken over for the day and the people in the background have got to be, they've got to be actors. They can't possibly be members of the public.
No, because... they are members of the public because various guests have said, are these people actors? They're, no, they're just people. And I think they just find a way of clearing the space and making it tolerable. But going back to the cars, these are very often collectors' cars, aren't they? Really remarkable old cars. Huge, so they have to somehow get those cars, and then they have to do whatever they have to do to get cameras in them.
Yeah,
which cannot be easy, you know. So huge amounts of work. But you know what struck me yesterday as the kind of the acme of the kind of professionalism of that production and Jerry Seinfeld. One of the things that makes it work is that Jerry Seinfeld, apart from his many other qualities, is a very generous laugher. So when his guests make a funny, he laughs.
He does. He falls about.
He falls about laughing.
And genuinely too.
But also he has worked out that you don't make the sound of laughter because that will cover up the person's humour, and you don't strike any surfaces in the act of laughing.
Because that would interrupt the sound.
So he does this kind of, I can't, you know, it's a silent.
No, you're right. I've never noticed that.
He mimes laughing, and he slaps the table, but he doesn't actually slap the table. He brings his hand down as if he's doing it, and he's not doing it.
Yes,
because
yes.
That would,
I've never noticed that. That's
that would make the
right.
Sound. Yeah. It's the technique that goes into making it look like there's no technique is absolutely remarkable. And then the nub of the conversation with comics is always the same. You know, where do you get your material from?
But don't you
what's
find
it
that
like to die? I find it. Absolutely.
Oh my God, the one I saw the other day, I think you saw it too, is that Steve Martin one.
It's Steve Martin.
Absolutely unbelievable what he tells you about the points he makes about comedy. Some of them really obvious, but you need to be reminded of them. He says when he went on stage, this was what, was it late early 70s? When was his peak as a
mid-70s was his
mid-70s.
Peak.
Mid-70s. Yeah. So when he went on stage, he said, nobody knew what they were going to get. You know, there was no social media. No one had seen clips of it.
No.
No one really knew what the material was. And he said, you went out there and you entertained these people and it was all new. You know, I thought that was really interesting. There was no competition, he felt, between the comedians. They were all... And it was new, like music was new. You know what I mean? There was stuff that just hadn't been done before.
Yeah.
And just a bit where he talks about what it's like. He goes on, I think it's Saturday Night Live or whatever, and he goes out to play his next date and he says to the... promoter, how many people are out there? They said 7,000. 7,000? It is that idea of adjusting to a crowd of 7,000 and how you play that crowd.
Yeah.
And then he said another interesting thing about it. He liked being paid in direct relation to the number of tickets he'd sold.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he said it reminded him of how successful he was and he felt he'd really earned it, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it was extraordinary. And then the other thing about Steve Martin, he gave up, didn't he?
He gave
just
up.
Stopped. He stopped. And he didn't say, he didn't announce he'd stopped. He just didn't do any more comedy. After a while, people thought, Steve Martin, what, he's in movies now, is he? Oh, I haven't seen him touring, you know. And he made the point that it's material, you know, that material...
He said it's 10 years. He says, new material is 10 years.
Yeah.
He said, it took me 10 years to generate the act that made me Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And therefore, once people have seen the joke, he says, it's a conceptual joke. It's very difficult to go back and do it again.
Yeah.
You've got to have a new joke. Well, a new joke takes 10 years, which was really interesting.
I thought that was fascinating. And also he says that he's coming out of a particular time. He's coming out of the end of kind of Vietnam and there's a certain sensibility. And to have somebody being as absurd as him and as carefree and as he puts it, happy-go-lucky, he invented this character that he thought was happy-go-lucky, he said, which is very far from what he's actually like in real life. Also, that's interesting because you're sustaining a character, acting a character that you're not.
Yeah.
So that must be hard. But I noticed... Stuart Lee is a really good example. I like Stuart Lee very much. Stuart Lee was making the point that the way comedy works now is because he used to do quite a bit on the TV, doesn't do the TV anymore. Right. Because if you do the TV, it uses up all your material. So he writes a show which takes forever. He then goes and does it in a 400-seater theatre in Leicester Square, 400 people a night for 2.5 months, sold out every night, and then puts out a DVD of it. And then that's gone. That whole thing is gone. Yeah. You never do any more of that ever again. And you're thinking, God, that's so labour intensive, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting. In one of them I was watching yesterday, Seinfeld was talking about what comedians did as compared to what humorous columnists did.
Yeah.
He said, humorous columnists, well, that's fine, he says, but they don't get to die. They have some columns that are really good and some that are less than good. It sort of doesn't matter. The less than good ones.
But it's not public humiliation.
It's not.
You're sitting at home thinking, shit, that wasn't very funny. But whereas this is, there's a bit where Steve Martin talks about being outstage. He said he counted that he'd been going for 25 minutes without a single laugh.
Says, can I go for the full half hour?
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I can make it. I know. Oh, it's incredible.
Those reflections on the kind of existential, part of being a comedian are absolutely fascinating all the way through the series, because everybody's got a story. You talk to Eddie Murphy, all these people, they can all remember dying. They remember it really clearly, and that's what drives them on.
And they learn huge amounts from that. It's all about trying out material tentatively and seeing if it gets a reaction. We talked about this before, but I've told you about watching Eddie Izzard and that thing during lockdown where he did a broadcast from Riverside Studios with no audience.
Oh, he can't do it.
So he's doing this kind of material, some of which he's never really done before, but he's got no idea whether it's working or not. And I have to tell you, it wasn't. Largely, it wasn't working. We were sitting here watching, thinking, this is not funny. And if he was in a room full of people not reacting, he'd very soon modify his course, wouldn't he?
All the conversation around comedians is not about jokes. It's just about laughter.
Yeah.
It's about how can you get laughter?
Yeah.
You know, Seinfeld, in one of them I was watching, talks about going to see a friend in hospital. He was on his deathbed.
Yeah.
And he made him laugh. And it was a joke about cancer. And he said, for that, those few seconds, he was happy.
Yeah.
And he thought, what's wrong with that? You know what I mean? It's absolutely justified, you know, because that was his job, to provide laughter, not to provide jokes, to provide laughter.
That's the Barry Cryer method, I think. I'm a great admirer of Barry Cryer's.
Another generous laugher.
Yeah, major laugh.
Really good on the radio. Because Barry Cryer laughs on the radio where you have to be heard.
Yeah.
So it's different Jerry
Seinfeld. He's really good. But he's got Barry Cryer's thing is he's got a gag on every single topic. And he puts on the Oldie website, he puts up a gag, I think, pretty much every day. And he put one up a couple of days ago. It's his hospital joke. And he says, this guy's in hospital and he leaves his hospital bed, dragging along behind him his drip. He's attached to his drip. He's still got his gown on. He goes across the road to the pub. He orders a double whiskey. The barman, very concerned, gives him the double whiskey and he drinks it. He says, "This is what I've got. I shouldn't have had that." And the barman says, "What have you got?" He says, "10p." You can't see it coming, can you? But it's so brilliantly set up because it's the idea of the guy in the pub and he's got the drip and the old pyjamas on. I don't know where it's going. And the barman's so concerned. What have you got? I think Barry Cryer is a master of that because his jokes are so tight and so, he's got just exactly the right amount of information to set them up. And that's from years and years, isn't it? Of just doing it, of knowing what works and what doesn't.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So a very sad loss this week. Our old friend and colleague, photographer Ken Sharp, died suddenly at the weekend. in St Andrews in Scotland, which is where he lived. And
wonderful man.
And lovely chap. And
did lots of
we'll be familiar to people who use ReQ, particularly in the early days. Because I think I was trying to work out how he got involved, because he took my picture for some trade magazine, probably Campaign or something like that, in the early 80s. And I got friendly with him. And when we started Q, we said, let's get Ken to take some pictures of kind of the rock stars and whatever. He'd never really done that before. He'd, mainly done simple portraits and kind of stuff in trade papers or whatever. But he became an absolutely crucial member of the team.
He was a big part of it. I mean, not just because he was such a lovely and friendly and sweet-natured guy, but he had an interesting way of taking photographs. What he was telling you to do is take pictures of, I think, business people, wasn't it? But in informal kind of situations. So the pictures always had a lot of information in them.
Yeah.
It'd be somebody's office, and you'd see a lot of the office and all the details, the things on the desk and the pictures behind them and other people walking in and out the shot, you know. And I think we thought that that was very attractive, because at that time, rock photography was it's quite staged, actually.
It was basically about the portrait, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about the portrait. Let's get a picture of somebody projecting whatever they think they're kind of, I'm trying
how
to
they want
brand
to be
values,
seen.
But how they want to be seen. Whereas Ken came in with these pictures. I can remember sending him off to do a piece about French and Saunders. Not that they're musicians, but that was a really good example. And he came back with these pictures of the two of them in the makeup room before they went on to this television show. And they're putting on makeup. And there's the mirror surrounded by the lights. Yeah. And there's all the makeup people coming in. And it was just so much to look at. It told you so much about them, actually, and the situation that they were in. And he often did that. There was a great... the Independent newspaper had done a bit of that, too, that instead of taking the news picture, they would be the ones who went back a bit and took a picture of all the other photographers taking the news picture to give you an idea of what this person was going through, you know.
Yeah.
He was an amazing, amazing...
So, we never discussed this with him really at all, but it became a really important part of it, because if Q's kind of editorial view was affectionate but faintly sceptical, Ken did that in photographs absolutely naturally, because he was like that. You know, he was affectionate but also vaguely sceptical.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't idolize any of these people at all, you know.
Not remotely.
But he saw them as they were, and the pictures that he took from those early days of Q are still fantastic pictures. And we were talking about him the other day. We were saying how many of them were of people smoking. And the reason was that this is the late 80s.
Yeah.
People still smoked, you know, obviously indoors, and they smoked during interviews. And Ken was quite an unobtrusive presence, who was usually in the room when the interview was being done, listening. And he was genuinely interested.
Yeah.
And also just occasionally, you know. And one of the few intervals where you could take that kind of picture without catching somebody with their mouth open is when they draw on a cigarette or they light a new cigarette.
Yeah.
And so many of these pictures ended up being the opening spread of features Eric Clapton, Lemmy, Lou Reed, you know what I mean?
I've got one right here. I'm just going to get it, actually. Hang on a moment.
Have you got one? It was always like a signature, you know. And I don't think he ever designed it that way. It was just that was the interval where you could take the picture.
See, this is a classic. Can you see that?
Oh, yeah, there you go. You got Lou Reed, right?
That's a picture of Lou Reed that he took and put it up really close.
Yeah,
it's absolutely fabulous. We made this into little Q postcards.
Right.
He did lots of them. There's a lovely one of Lemmy as well, the lighting. Well, lots of people. But that was a great moment. When people lit cigarettes, it was a punctuation, wasn't it? It gave you a chance to get them doing something different, you know. God, it's amazing how much smoking used to be a part of those kind of photographs. Do you remember Herman Leonard's 40s and 50s jazz pictures?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Oh, incredible. Dexter Gordon and Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
Inconceivable without
cigarettes. They were just wreathed in smoke.
Yes.
There'd be sort of saxophone players playing, and the smoke was kind of almost as if it was like the clouds of notes kind of flying out the end of their horn, you know. It was absolutely amazing.
Well, so that's Ken Sharp, who was sadly missed by
He will.
You know, well, loads of people and people who work with him. And loads of people on cue, you know, like I've been in touch this week with Matt Snow and John Hazelwood and Paul DeNoyer and you know, people like this. And they all said the same thing. I traveled the world with Ken. Yeah. I saw the world with Ken, you know. And apart from being a wonderful photographer, he was an absolute delightful traveling companion. It's a very, very sad loss.
A really lovely guy.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
So, Alex, what do we have to talk about in any other business this week? Anything further? What have we got coming up? We got on July the 17th, in case, you know, tickets still going for that.
Word in the Park.
For our Word in the Park in Holden Park in London, where we guarantee that someone will be shining. But it doesn't matter if it's not, because we're under a canopy.
Under canvas.
Under a canopy. And we'll be announcing further details about that. And
It's a weatherproof occasion.
In the next week. But you can, where can you find details of that, Alex?
You can find details. We'll put a link in the show notes to the ticket page itself. But there's also a widget on wiyelondon.com right in the front of the homepage.
Okay, so make sure you get your tickets. And we're looking forward to seeing you. It's a socially distanced, very comfortable environment for a couple of hours on a Saturday afternoon. And it also happens to be the same day as Record Store Day.
Yeah.
So if you're somebody outside London who's looking for an excuse to come into London and go to a Word event, that could be a perfect day out for you. Okay, what else we got coming up? What have we got out there in the world?
New patrons, we do.
We have on board Peter Clitheroe.
Hello, Peter.
Good man. Welcome aboard.
Chris Bork.
Okay.
Excellent.
Hello, Chris. Chris Bork from New Zealand. I know Chris.
From New Zealand, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. Hello, Chris.
Stephanie Killian.
Hello, Stephanie. Good, nice Stephanie. To have you on board.
And David Dowie.
All welcome. And people are more than welcome to join them. And if you want details about how you might do that, if you go to patreon.com/wordinyourear, you can find out how you can be involved. What have we published in the last week? Rich Thompson, Bernie Marsden. Bernie Marsden,
if you haven't very seen good,
it,
I thought.
If you haven't Richard seen it already, both of them really good in there.
Bernie Marsden's hilarious. And both so of them likable.
Both of them kind of 50-year veterans of playing guitar in bands.
So
really.
Much wisdom and knowledge.
Absolutely
incredible. Wisdom being a key word. Actually, what I have learned,
and loads more coming up in the weeks ahead. So you know, get on board.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.